I'm not saying that that Dev was able to walk in the water, but he brought us very near to it.
Sean McEntee, a friend and colleague of Eamon de Valera for almost 60 years, a member of every Fianna Fáil cabinet led by de Valera, with him a founder member of Fianna Fáil, like him a 1916 veteran, and like him sentenced to death for his role in the Easter Rising, and reprieved. In fact, it was in the workroom in Dartmoor Prison in England, after the Rising, that de Valera and McEntee first discussed politics, at their first meeting. McEntee had just come off a month's solitary confinement when he first met the man who was to change his life. In the month of his 93rd birthday this past summer, Sean McEntee recalled Eamon de Valera, his career, his personality, his achievements, his disappointments.
Mr. McEntee, it was a summer's day in July 1917 that you first met Eamon de Valera, but in unique circumstances.
Well, I think it was a summer's day. I don't remember. I wasn't impressed with the weather because in Dartmoor, it's nothing but it's a very drab sort of place, even in summertime. But it was.
Did you know who he was then?
Well, I did when I, because I had seen photographs of him, but I had never met him before, before that June in Dartmoor. So we marched off and into this huge room. It could hold at least 100 prisoners sitting on benches, divided at intervals of 2 feet at least between them, so that you couldn't, if you wanted to talk audibly, you'd had to raise your voice to be heard. And I was put down on a bench in front of a man who was peddling away thorough, industriously, put it that way, on a sewing machine. And then after a bit, he said, "Who are you?" No, sotto voce, you know, you have to talk to your, without moving your lips. It's an art which you acquire. And I told him I was. And then when he heard that I was in Belfast, he started to talk about Belfast. And what impressed me was how little he knew about it. And Dev was surprised to find that though I had been in the Volunteers and the Rising, that I had a great admiration for Joe Devlin. And I had, because until Joe came along and became MP for West Belfast, elected by a majority of 16 votes, the Northern Nationalists, the Northern Catholics, who were mainly Nationalists, well, we're completely ground down. So Dev was surprised that I should have such an admiration for him. And I had. And then we got on talking. But the real thing about it was that it didn't surprise me. Because after all, how could it? That people knew so little about the Northern situation, Northern scene.
You were whispering then to de Valera across the table, in the workshop,
yes,
in Dartmoor. Were you in the same seating for a couple of days?
Oh, no, for all the period that Dev was there. But you see, we had nothing to talk about once we got over the preliminaries. Once he realised that Devlin wasn't as black as he was painted.
Also, you were on record as saying that his belief then was that the whole problem in the North was due to British guile and nothing else.
Yes, he was. He was only that. That's true. But nobody who lived in Belfast, grown up in Belfast, believed that.
Had you any idea then that your career, your public career, would be so intertwined with this man across the table?
Oh, none whatever. I know none whatever. You see, when I was released from Dartmoor, when we weren't released, we were first of all transferred from Dartmoor to Lewes, and then we were dispersed. I was released in Portland. But when we came back home, of course, we found the whole situation had changed. And Dev's election, candidature in East Clare had been declared, and we went down to help him. And so we were drawn into politics. And that's the way it came. I hadn't any idea of a political career in when I went into the volunteers. It just happened that destiny shaped my ends.
But you were very active in the East Clare by-election and in the South Armagh by-election.
I was, yes.
And you went on an organising tour, a Sinn Féin organising tour of Tyrone, Derry and Donegal with De Valera.
Oh, yes, yes.
In the early 1918.
Yes.
Well, what do you remember?
How did you find that out?
Well, it's reported in the local newspapers at the time.
I became very close to Dev during that period. In fact, I was the, how would you put it? I created the original prototype of Dev's long coat in the train. You see, you wrapped it across your knees and so on. You were comfortable. So Dev saw me wearing one of these and he followed suit. It's the only time he imitated me.
What was De Valera like then as a public speaker in that time?
At that time, he was less in time to be the doctrinaire, the teacher. He did. But then he was, at that time, he certainly devoted himself almost entirely, to the question. The big question then was, would we be represented at the peace conference, which was to be held when the war ended? And he was really more concerned to establish and to vindicate the Easter Rising.
It is fortunate that the question of the recognition of the Republic arises at this time. It is doubly fortunate that America is strong enough to decide upon it boldly, without fear, in the way its conscience prompts. Ireland's cause is not Ireland's cause only. It is the cause of the world. It is the cause of right and of justice and of true democracy everywhere.
De Valera in the United States, 1920. He returned from there at Christmas of that year after 18 months in America. 1921 was a year of political strategy. July brought the truce and talks in London with Lloyd George. Throughout October and November, the plenipotentiaries were negotiating with the British cabinet in London. On December the 6th, the treaty was signed. Sinn Féin divided on the issue, but few of those contributing to the historic debate on the treaty in the Dáil emphasised partition. It was virtually ignored.
Everybody was sold. Well, most of those who participated in the debate were all sold on the idea that the Boundary Commission was going to reduce the seceding counties, the six counties as it was then, to a non-viable state.
McEntee's own predictions, warnings that the treaty would entrench partition, proved more prophetic. The Civil War followed through the winter of 1922-23. The Republicans accepted their failure to make advances through military means, but they did not accept defeat. Rather, they determined to turn to politics as an extension of war by other means. They had their own underground army, Dáil, and civil administration, but these proved ineffective. From 1925 at least, there were broad hints, some evidence, that a more pragmatic approach might be tried. The collapse of the Boundary Commission in November-December 1925 hastened this development. By March 1926, De Valera and his followers, including McEntee, had split with Sinn Féin. In May of that year, Fianna Fáil was founded.
I put it to Sinn Féin or this. I put then that as a national policy. It was turned down. And there was nothing left for us to do, those who believed that we could to a large extent retrieve the national fortunes, than to found a new organization. We founded Fianna Fáil.
De Valera wrote to a friend about the new party. What will be the fate of this new venture, I do not know. I have at any rate done my duty and launched the ship on the sea of fate. If favourable winds blow, I may bring her safely to harbour. If not, well, I'm prepared to go down trying. For its first year, Fianna Fáil was an abstentionist party. It did not enter Leinster House. It fought the June 1927 election as an abstentionist party. And it was only after the assassination of Kevin O'Higgins and the consequent legislation which obliged all parliamentary candidates to take the oath if they wished to contest elections, it was only in these new circumstances that Fianna Fáil faced the inevitable. They accepted the oath in August 1927 as an empty formula, and they entered Leinster House.
But we did certainly know that we couldn't make any progress on the basis which we were doing. It remained to be seen that how good, how sound were our anticipations. And we did expect that we would certainly do better going into the Dáil than staying out of the Dáil, because, after all, you can't expect people to continue to vote into Parliament. People have no influence.
Fianna Fáil's gains in the election, which took place the following month, the September 1927 election, were some indication of the public's support for their new pragmatism. Nonetheless, they remained, in Sean Lamass's phrase in the Dáil, a slightly constitutional party. When the next election came in January 1932, Fianna Fáil was successful. De Valera, in less than a decade, had reversed the outcome of the Civil War. Some asked whether the victors in the Civil War would accept their defeat at the ballot box. Some Fianna Fáil members entering Leinster House after the 1932 election to inherit the fruits of their victory also had doubts, and some took precautions.
Are the stories, though, of Fianna Fáil coming into power that day in the Dáil with guns in their back pockets, are they true?
Well, that's due to Frank Aiken. Frank Aiken was very distrustful. Frank Aiken probably, nothing more than that. We came in. I was handed a revolver, but I wasn't handed any cartridges. the revolver wasn't for use, but it was for intimidation.
It will be the dawn of a new day for Ireland. Our people in the United States, in Britain, in Australia, will know a gladness they have not experienced since 1921.
But this was a new dawn, wasn't it? I mean, Fianna Fáil, the expectations were very considerable within the party.
Well, it was made worth it. You had to unduly reward anybody who invests in your industries. And it took a lot. And, of course, we had to train our people.
One of the points, again, that some of the Fianna Fáil, the expectations within the party seems to have been that once De Valera got to power then, that you were inheriting a civil service machine that had been staffed from Cumann na Gael patronage, if you like, or they were professionals too, and the army likewise. Now, how difficult was it to take over the machinery of government since you had been outside it?
Well, I was Minister of Finance and supposed to be, in that capacity, responsible for the civil service. The only department which any question arose, well, there were two. Well, justice, where there was a certain degree of financial, of political distrust. Now, whether the distrust was well, I don't think the distrust was well founded, but distrust rises outside of your control. And the army, for a moment, but as against that, we knew, well, the guards, O'Duffy. Now, we knew that O'Duffy had been, as I said, we knew that's too strong a word, but we suspected that O'Duffy had tried plan a coup d'etat to keep us from coming in, and that Michael Brennan, who was chief of staff, refused to cooperate. Now, Michael Brennan was some clerk. He was the chief of staff. So the army came over, and old W.T. Cosgrave refused to have anything to do with any sort of proposal of keeping us out of power. Now it only indicates the degree of political nous that the Irish people had.
Picking a fight, though, with England then, the economic war, there were political advantages to that, weren't there?
Well, yes, there was, of course. You see, after all, we are in a position to say to the Irish farmers, who were providing the bulk of the annuities, if you stand by us on this, well, you're going to benefit. And they... But look, that wasn't the main appeal. The main appeal is, look, when it comes down to hard tax, the patriotic, the Irishman is as patriotic as any other man you'll find anywhere, and is prepared to sacrifice as much as the most sacrificial.
What was De Valera's view then, at that point, coming into power, of the political stability in the state, because the IRA was then very strong. It was part of it saw De Valera as a potential Kerensky, a man who would take power but who could be pushed aside in certain circumstances. There was the rise of the Blue Shirts. They were
They came from the north. They were not of the same lineage.
Yes. That's my point, that there were, on all sides, there were difficulties.
Well, there were. Of course there were. But what's a government there except to surmount civil difficulties? Now, you can't surmount economic difficulties. That's a fallacy that the government operates in a vacuum and that you can do whatever you like inside it. No, it's a no. But certainly, so far as the political issues were concerned, I had to solve. But you see, don't forget, when we did take power in 1932 as a minority government, 1933, when we had played the card. No, I'm not saying play in what you might call as a pejorative sense. When we had laid down, when we had abolished the oath, well, you know, that made an extraordinary difference. And withheld the annuities. I mean, we had a very good election in 1933.
Last November, in the Dáil, I said that it was our intention to give a substantial permanent reduction in the annuities which the farmers were paying. I knew we were going to unite the Irish people and bring together the people who were marching together in the past. But I didn't think we'd reunite them so quickly as to get Mr. Cosgrave at last to see that the Irish tenant farmer couldn't afford to pay these annuities and send them over to England so easily as he was in the past.
The economic war with Britain, while resulting in some economic difficulties in Ireland, did have political advantages for Fianna Fáil. Rowing with the ancient enemy went down well with Republican voters, particularly those concerned with Fianna Fáil's credentials as the mainstream Republican Party. The abolition of the oath, the humiliation and then abolition of the office of Governor-General, the abolition of the Privy Council, of the Free State Senate, all helped consolidate nationalist Republican support behind Fianna Fáil, as did the External Relations Act in December 1936, by which the King was excluded from the Constitution. If the British had had any doubts about De Valera's revision of the treaty since his arrival in power in 1932, it must have been clear by now that De Valera was intending to do no less than incrementally to introduce Document Number 2, his celebrated alternative to the treaty, which had been rejected in the aftermath of the treaty debate 15 years before. External association with the British Commonwealth, De Valera's bespoke formula, was also intended as bait for the Ulster Unionists.
All right, it was an attempt to have regard to the feelings of the Ulster Unionists, and that they hoped that this would manage that. There's no doubt he had that in his mind, but I can't say what was in his mind. But it certainly was. You see, he had mentioned external association during the course of the treaty debates.
How fine an appreciation had he by now, in your view, of the intractability of the partition issue?
I don't think he had. I think that all the time he felt that the British were supporting and upholding the six county people, the six county establishment. I don't think that he realized how innate their desire to be associated with their co-religionists in Great Britain. He didn't realize how strong that was. Now, I remember him. I have only a faint, more than a faint recollection. I remember that Erskine Childers Senior, he said to me once that Erskine Childers had told him that it wasn't a matter so much of political allegiance as of religion, religious conviction, that they were they didn't want, or the Northerners didn't want to be under the thumb of the of Rome. And you know, in those days, when John Charles and others were rampant, there was a great... No, I shouldn't say rampant about John Charles, because he was a man of very sincere convictions.
But there was a very strong Catholic influence in the political culture of the South then.
Oh, there was. Yes. Oh, and there was. Sure, that's when we had Christ the King and...
Maria Duce.
Maria Duce was one, but another one. However, it doesn't matter.
But these were lobbying during the preparation for the new constitution as well, and there was a lobby suggesting there should be a state, that the Catholic Church should be the state church.
Yes, well, of course, Dev wouldn't have that. Though, one or two, to my surprise, one or two members of the government at that stage were quite prepared to consider it.
To advocate it or consider it?
Oh, consider it. They wouldn't have it at all. Neither would myself and Jerry Bowland and a few others, Frank Aiken.
The outstanding event of the year was the adoption by the people of a constitution based on their own Christian conception of life, embodying their own political, social, and cultural ideals, and providing the framework for future development in accordance with the national genius and tradition.
To Britain's surprise, since they believed the constitution had set back the prospect for an improvement in Anglo-Irish relations, still less any North-South rapprochement, to Britain's surprise, De Valera, late in 1937, proposed a full-scale review of Anglo-Irish relations. Neville Chamberlain, by then Prime Minister, accepted. The records of these negotiations from January to March of 1938 and the agreement itself in April show how, on the Irish side, one man did almost all the talking, De Valera. Very little was said by the other Irish ministers who attended the negotiations, Sean Lemass, James Ryan and Sean McEntee.
Of course, you can't have it. You can't have people talking across... Well, there were odd interjections. You can't have people talking across purposes in a delegation. One man, the delegation decides what the line is going to be. Well, it doesn't decide it, and that's a rough sense. But there's a discussion afterwards about what happened in the morning and what you're going to do the next day. And you see, the leader of the delegation is the person who is the spokesman for the delegation. Now, on occasions, you see, if you think the thing's not going on the way you think it should go and it's going to diversify, you throw in an odd remark and you try and get the thing back in line. But that. Now, that reminds me. They talk of Neville Chamberlain as being an appeaser. Now, I was over in that delegation with Chamberlain, and we were talking about getting back the ports, and Dev was making the poor mouth about it, how much it was going to cost us. But and Chamberlain came in with a shy remark of his about, you know, if it's going to cost you so much, Mr. De Valera, perhaps you'd like to do without the ports. But anyhow, we were talking about how much it was going to cost us, because this had got to come in to the financial end of it, how much it was going to cost us to put the revitalize the ports and rearm them and so on and modernize them. And I said to him, a question arose as to when this would have to be done and the amount of money it was going to cost. And I said to Chamberlain, who was then Minister, Prime Minister, I said to Chamberlain, now, when do you expect that the situation is going to come to a head? Well, he said, if you ask me, Mr. McEntee, I'd say if I were Mr. Hitler, I'd strike now because we are completely unprepared. Now, that's the explanation of Munich.
Following the 1938 agreement, De Valera's greatest difficulty was in persuading his followers, including some TDs and some members of his cabinet, that no progress on partition had been possible at the London talks. But it was now emphasised in Fianna Fáil rhetoric that the partition issue had been isolated, that in all other respects the Anglo-Irish relationship was as it should be. And Neville Chamberlain permitted Fianna Fáil to carry on a propaganda campaign in Britain on the partition issue.
He said, look, we can't do it, but if you can move our people... He said, my opinion, partition is an anachronism. And he welcomed us and he advised us to go out. And he didn't advise us. He said, if you can convert the Irish and the British people, you'll have no opposition from me. And we founded the Anti-Partition League on that basis. And then there came the Gloucester bombings and the other things. And that makes me very doubtful about the bona fides of some of the things that happened since that.
Soon enough, the context was changed. War was declared in Europe. The emergency was proclaimed in Ireland.
Noting the march of events, your government decided its policy early last spring and announced its decision to you and to the world. We resolved that the aim of our policy would be to keep our people out of the war.
Whatever else happened, we wanted to come out of the war independent, and we certainly didn't want to back any loser.
And there was a time, obviously, in the summer of 1940, when every American journalist returning from Europe, when half the British cabinet believed that Britain was going to lose.
Yes, of course, that was a very trying time. And it would have been, from my point of view, I think of the majority of my colleagues, would be a disaster to us if Britain were to lose the war. Because after all, what bulwark have we between the continent and ourselves? We would be old. If any European power were able to overrun Britain, where would we be? And try to let people feel that you are on the right side. Whatever, you didn't say what side it was, but our side was to keep out of the war. Nothing else. We had only one objective. I mean, whatever our mental approach might be, coming down to the practical work of running this state, we had to keep out of the war. We had already lost too many men in the previous war. And apart from that, we had achieved our independence. This was the test of it. When we go through that war and come out of it, emerge from it, independent. And that was our job. It was very much, like one of the biblical stories about the boat on the lake when the storm sprang up. I'm not saying that Dev was able to walk in the water, but he brought us very near to it.
How real, though, within the cabinet then, in the summer of 1940, was the fear of the possibility of a German landing in Ireland?
Well, it was always present. I mean, when the British were driven out of Europe, the possibility that the Germans would try to land, and you see, they had their, don't forget, they had sent in their spies before that, and they were preparing the ground, and there was a certain crowd here who believed in the authoritarian state. There were some very prominent nationalists among them who were quite prepared to invite them in. Well, that was all right because they didn't, perhaps it was because they didn't believe in democracy, I don't know. But there were some. I'm not mentioning their names because they're all dead and they can't repudiate me.
So you're saying that within the Fianna Fáil cabinet then in the summer of 1940, there was this genuine worry and concern that there might be an invasion of Ireland?
Oh yes, there was. It was on the cards. Now, who was going to invade us? Some thought it would be some of the British. others thought that the Germans, with all their submarines and so on, the human mind is prone to exaggeration. And those who saw the Germans sweeping across Europe said, there's no battery there, it'll come here. And that they weren't. They weren't numerous. No. Some who thought that after Dunkirk, the Germans would be in our country. And they were civil servants, they weren't politicians. Now that's as far as I'm going.
And in external affairs?
In external affairs.
Very senior.
Right?
Very senior people.
Well, we didn't hear from the juniors. And as well as that, there's one fact that we have to abide with. Whatever we like it or not, Britain is one bulwark against a European invasion. No, that's one fact. They lie between us and the continent. And after all, the Romans came to Britain and they didn't get past Britain, and where would we be? We'd be more holier than the Romans are now.
Those are the first facts of history are geographical.
Yes, that's it. You are. You have to stand where you are. You have to die where you stand, put it that way.
There's a community which has been mercifully spared from all major sufferings, as well as from the blinding hates and rancors engendered by the present war. We shall endeavor to render thanks to God by playing a Christian part in helping so far as a small nation can to bind up some of the gaping wounds of suffering humanity.
De Valera's achievement as national leader during the war gave him a stature which he had not known since 1921, pre-treaty. Neutrality had been elevated to a sacred principle by much of the electorate. Yet as with Churchill in Britain, at the first post-war election, office was lost by the man who had proved such a popular leader during the war. How disappointed was De Valera at his loss of power in 1948, after 16 continuous years in office?
Well, he was. He wasn't as hurt as some of his higher civil servants were. I remember Jimmy McGinley coming in to me on the day that Dev was defeated. And he was in tears, weeping. They were horrified at the idea they would reject me. But you see, we had done all the dirty work, the rationing and so on and so on. And people, after all, you get tired. You like a change, even if it's only a change of hat or shirt. So that's what happened. 16 years of one government. They say we try the other fellows now.
And what was your verdict on the other fellows after 3 years? They had the mother and child scheme, which was...
The mother and child scheme was our scheme. That's what's forgotten.
Well, I know that, and you brought it through and you delivered it past the obstacles. But I'm saying that the method of in which it ended up was a debit, wasn't it?
Well, of course. it blew the gaff on the unity of Clown the public.
And then the repeal of the External Relations Act. A lot of their...
Oh, that was a disaster. I mean, not a disaster, that's an exaggeration, but it was certainly a disadvantage. Because, look, as long as we had that there, it was a cobweb. And the British had to make sure that the cobweb didn't break.
The leader of the opposition and the Dáil, Deputy Governor.
At a monster all-party rally in O'Connell Street in Dublin, De Valera joined Costello, MacBride and Norton in condemning the Ireland Act, the British government's new guarantee to the Ulster Unionists.
Britain has created this position. Britain has maintained this position. By the bill in her parliament today, she is seeking to consolidate it. The design must be opposed by the Irish race by every means that is effective and just.
Fianna Fáil returned to power in 1951 for 3 years, and again after another period of coalition in 1957, De Valera returned for his last term as Taoiseach. Sean McEntee served in both these governments. McEntee resigned from the cabinet in 1969 and from the Dáil in 1973, the same year in which De Valera retired from public life when he completed his second term as president. Looking back then over almost 60 years of friendship and political cooperation, how would Sean McEntee sum up Eamon De Valera?
How can I sum up Dev in three or four sentences? I can't. Because, you see, in my mind, he looms larger than life. Well, that's, again, an exaggeration in the sense that he was life. He wasn't larger than he was just it. He was really a very upright, simple, unostentatious man, though very serious in his thought. He never jumped to a conclusion. I mean, I remember there were, when we were on occasions in the early days, before 1939, before the war broke out, when we were doing the amending the Constitution. How you would have a long discussion in the cabinet during that period when people were tense and thinking hard, and you'd go home thinking the thing had been disposed of, and you find yourself summoned to a meeting because somebody, now like a person I'm not going to mention, had said something which Dev thought was relevant to the thing and hadn't been given sufficient attention, and you'd be brought back to consider it. He never disregarded an opinion. It was offered to him, and he analysed it, and he judged it, and decided whether it was good or bad. But the thing, of course, if he made up his mind and that, it was very hard to get him to unmake it. It wasn't that he was stubborn, but you had to have a logical argument, something which would stand up. But in ordinary, it was in the cabinet. And in the cabinet, everybody had an equal voice. Now, we had no votes in the cabinet. We had an expression of opinion. We go round the table, and somebody would say something, and then the persons had an opportunity of answering that, and then Dev would sum up. And generally, almost universally, his consensus was accepted as the voice of the cabinet. Now, we didn't have any votes, because that's a divisive procedure.
Mr. Lamass, of course, told the joke that you took a vote by a minority of one, i.e. De Valera had his way.
That's not exactly true. It is an oversimplification of the fact that De Valera presented a consensus of opinion which was acceptable to the majority without the majority having to disclose itself. You know what I mean? You don't have to say, yes, I'm for it, which is a divisive procedure. So that was he in cabinet. Now, as a friend, as a man, he wasn't a chap who went out of his way to make jokes. But if you made a joke and it was good enough, he would enjoy it as much as anybody else, provided it didn't get over the border. Now, he didn't like anything which is too blue. He didn't mind it being a pale blue line, a Mechlin blue, if you know what I mean. He didn't mind that at all. You could say things like that to him. You could make jokes about him. But he was very, as I think I said to you before, he was really a friend. I recited Jerry Bowles so many times because Jerry was a typical Dubliner. And Jerry talked about it and say, come off it, or something like that. And they wouldn't say it in a rude way. And they would come off the laugh. But there's no, but who are others? So look at, so myself and Dev are many stand up, and so are Lamass, and so are Jim Ryan, and Paddy Smith. now dead and gone, God have mercy. But Paddy Smith and Dev, they talk like two countrymen talking to each other. Oh, no. No, you see, the thing about it was the general public, the population, erected Dev. And it wasn't, he didn't seek this, but it wasn't trustable. It was self-imposed, if you put, I can't find the word, but he was elevated.
How disappointed would you say he was at the end of his life at the failure of some of his central goals, the unity of the country and the restoration of the language?
Oh, very disappointed about the restoration of the language. Very. I'd say that. About the other, he began to realise that how difficult the task was and how it was going to represent, as it will in the end, represent a certain diversion, of course, on our part. Because, you see, there can't be unity without a meeting of hands. And somebody's got to, the meeting has got to be arranged some way. we can't both be going on opposition courses in the sense of we're both receding from each other. When we start around, we have to make the turn and seek a union, it's going to be very difficult. But it might be so difficult because the world would impose it upon us.
But he saw that, you think, at the end of his life?
I think he saw at the end of his life. He told, and I told you about Erskine Childers, the late Erskine, telling the Dev said to me, look, Erskine always told me that I was on the wrong track. That it wasn't the British. It was a solid block of followers of John Knox and followers of Henry VIII, or of Elizabeth I, who were afraid of Rome. It was the old British. They had carried it over with them from Great Britain, if you like, but after all, they've been 400 years in Ireland. I wonder how long the Celts were before they...
A great man, you said, of De Valera, and Moses even, who led a small people out of bondage.
That's my true opinion. And he did. Who else created such an organization as Fianna Fáil, which endured for 50 years and more, nearly 60 now, without a split? What's going to happen in the future, I'm not foretelling. But imagine that. I mean, we started with nothing. I mean, the people who were the rank and file of, who were they? Not only the rank and file, but the commissioned officers and so on, in Fianna Fáil, we started. Were fellows who hadn't one sixpence to rub against another. They come out of the internment camps. But no business, no job, no anything. And no dole. But that was the spirit of the country.
Sean McEntee, remembering the career of Eamon de Valera. The interview was recorded last August in the month of Mr. McEntee's 93rd birthday.
I'm not saying that Dev was able to walk in the water, but he brought us very near to it.